We'll start with a work session on bill introduction.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill LC 4098 be adopted as a committee bill, and then I'll speak to the motion, Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist moves LC 4098 be adopted as a committee bill. Discussion?
Mr. Chair, just a regular disclaimer that we're putting this into the queue for discussion, and a vote one way or the other doesn't reflect the position on the legislative concept.
Further discussion? Seeing none. Objection? Seeing none. So ordered. The bill is introduced as a committee bill. And now I'd like to open up a work session on House Bill 2383.
Do you want me to make a motion? You want
yes,
me?
Please.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2383 without recommendation back to the Senate President's for re-referral to another committee.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2383 back to the Senate President's office for re-referral to another committee. Any discussion? Seeing none. Any objections? Seeing none. All right. With those two things out of the way, let's first open up a public hearing on the.
We can do that. You want to do 262 first?
No,
I don't. 836 is the one that's related to the homestead exception, so we could go to the information.
All right. I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 836, and at the same time, we'll have an informational meeting on an overview of the senior property tax program. Kyle will give us a presentation on what the bill does and how it relates to that venerable program that we've been working on forever, at least it seems.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Yes, we have SB 836 today, which it requires the Department of Revenue study the homestead property tax deferral program, but it does have a relating to the homestead property tax deferral program. So we thought before we spoke about anything, a bill related to the deferral program, we'd have the Department of Revenue come up here to give a background presentation on the senior disabled deferral program. Some of the background and also where the program is today in comparison and everything.
Okay, thanks. Let's bring up John Phillips and Bronson from the department, and this is placeholder language in that bill, so there is an amendment coming.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. And I'm here to answer questions, but Bronson Rueda, our program manager, is going to be going through sort of the background of the recent changes to the deferral program, and if you ready for that?
We're ready when you are.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bronson Rueda, and I'm the manager of the deferral program at the Department of Revenue. I'm here today to simply give a high-level overview of the program and to also give a little bit of information on the financial health of the program as well. So referring to the PowerPoint on the screen, what are the deferral programs? It's a chance for seniors or disabled citizens of Oregon, a chance to defer their taxes, and the department pays those taxes to the county in their stead, and in order for us to recoup those that deferred property tax amount, we place a lien on the homestead, which helps us collect that money back when a disqualifying event happens. Right now, the taxpayers are required to recertify every 2 years, and that ensures that they still meet the requirements of the program. And I mentioned before that the program is paid back when a disqualifying event happens, and those disqualifying events include when a taxpayer passes away, when a property is sold, or if the property transfers ownership, if the taxpayer moves from their homestead for reasons other than health issues, and if it's a manufactured structure or floating home, if that is moved out of the state, that also triggers disqualification. Before 2009, the program started in 1963, and it was designed to be self-sustaining, meaning all the money coming in was there to defer taxes for the seniors, and in November, that money would go to the counties to pay those taxes. So the big moment in time for the deferral program is November 15th, when all those taxes are paid to the counties, and this last year it was approximately $14 million. In 2006, the Oregon Project Independence, they took $250,000 from the deferral program. It was transferred, and then in 2008, $14.3 million was also transferred to OPI. Shortly thereafter, the residential market started to collapse in Oregon, and that was due to the downturn in the economy in late 2007, early 2008. And it was at that time our research department determined that the deferral program would no longer be able to be self-sustaining in the next couple of years. So some of those factors that attributed to that was dropping home values, a decline in home sales that reduced the cash flow coming into the program. And then because of the downturn in the economy, more seniors and disabled people in Oregon wanted to get onto the program, so that was more people coming into the program. So those two events indicated that the cash flow would no longer be sustainable and we would reach a zero balance within the next couple of years. So in 2010, if you remember, November 15th is the date that we make our big payment to the taxes. It was determined that we would not have enough money in our cash balance to in order to make those payments to the counties. And so we paid a portion in 2010, and then in May 2011, we paid the remainder of the balance. And then also in that year, Senate Bill 939 was passed, and that loaned the deferral program $19 million in order to continue. And then that same year, House Bill 2543 passed, which created major structural changes to the program. Before I get into those major structural changes to the program, I just think it's important to point out that the previous requirements of the program were just a couple. You had to be under a certain income limitation, and then also you had to be over an age, certain age, and that's 62. Unless you had a qualified disability, then you could get in at any age. When House Bill 2543 was passed, there were many new requirements, and those are listed up there. I'll go through them briefly. There was still an income limitation, but it was changed to a household income limitation, which simply means that if there was one person that applied for the program, but three people earning income in the house, all of that income had to be counted towards the application process. There was also an RMV limitation, and that was tied to the county medium for which the homestead resides. You had to have proof of insurance. You needed to be in your homestead for at least 5 years, and you could no longer have a reverse mortgage. And there was also a $500,000 household asset limitation, and that amount has not changed since 2011. Some other changes in 2011 from House Bill 2543 was, as I mentioned before, the recertification process. And in the law, it states that has to be done at least every 3 years, but we do it every 2 years. And how we work that is we tie it into the main account holder's Social Security number, the last digit. If it's odd, then they recertify every odd year. If it's even, they recertify every even year. And the account balance that is accumulated and kept by the program is traditionally, it accumulates 6% interest, and that's simple interest. In 2011, they changed that simple interest to compound interest. So that changed in 2011 as well. A lot of people were upset by some of the changes in 2011, and program participation dropped approximately 31%. Mainly due to the increased requirements. Not everybody could stay in the program. It upset some taxpayers, a lot of taxpayers, and the Department of Revenue, as well as legislators, received thousands of phone calls from taxpayers expressing their displeasure. Then in 2012, more changes were made to the deferral program. House Bill 4039 was passed, and what that did is it gave a two-year reprieve to anyone who was inactivated in 2011 solely from having a reverse mortgage, and they had to have sent their recertification in by February 1st. And that affected approximately 1,500 people. Then in 2013, two more House bills were passed, House Bill 2489 and House Bill 2510. I'll go through both of those briefly, starting with House Bill 2489. The previous year, those 1,500 people that were allowed to stay in for 2 years, well, now they were allowed to stay in the program into perpetuity. So they were no longer going to be inactivated after 2 years, even though they had a reverse mortgage. House Bill 2510, this one gets a little confusing. It took us a while to implement it, but stated simply, it allows participants who are inactivated in 2011 solely due to having a reverse mortgage or not meeting the five-year residency requirement or both to participate again starting in January 1st, 2014. Now, I think it's important to note that these people that were identified from House Bill 2510, they weren't just allowed to come back into the program. They had to send in a new application through the county, and they had to meet all the other requirements in order to participate in the deferral program. We anticipated that 2,200 people could potentially come back into the program, and if all 2,200 came back in, then there would be a cash flow problem because come November 15th, if we had an additional 2,200 people, there might not be enough money to pay to those counties. So the limit was placed on how many could come in due to House Bill 2510, and that limit was 700 people. After the application season was over, it actually turned out that only 157 had applied and were accepted due to House Bill 2510. Now in 2014, there was another legislative change, and that was a reversion from the change to compound interest, now went back to simple interest. And that is going to be implemented sometime in 2016 is when we have to do that. This year, as you know, there's more changes that could be coming down for the deferral program, new legislation. And at the same time, I think it's important to note that the deferral program is in going through the Core Systems Replacement, or CSR, rollout 2 in the department at the Department of Revenue. And although it's very early in rollout 2, we don't know at this point what efficiencies will be gained, but we're very optimistic and very hopeful that there will be efficiencies after this rollout 2, and that will end in late December of this year. Now, the next five slides focus on some of the financial health of the program, and I'll kind of highlight what I think is important to note on these slides. So what you're looking at here is a revolving account balance. Year over year for the last 5 years, actually the last 3 years, and then 3 years projected forward. There is one mistake on this slide that I need to point out, and that is the vertical line between December 14th to December 15th and December 15th to December 16th. That vertical line should be moved over to the left one column. So the first 3 years have happened, and the last 3 years are projected. If you look at the very last row, the December 1st balance, that is the balance after the November 15th tax payment. So that's at the low point of the year. And if you look at the history, it went down, and it's projected to slowly increase, which is good. It's good that the account has good health going forward. But I think it's also important to point out, if you look at the repayments line, which is second from the top, that has slowly gone down as well. So if you look at that trend, the money coming in is slowly going down. The money going out is slowly going up. If those two lines cross, that would be bad because then the account balance will go down and the health of the program will be in jeopardy. The next slide is a visualization of what I just explained. The dotted red line is the cash fund balance. That's the amount that the program has as of November 16th or shortly after the November 15th tax payment each year. And as you can see, it's projected to steadily go up through 2021. But again, you look at the other solid lines, the blue line represents the tax payments that are going out to the counties. That is scheduled to slowly increase. And then the solid green line slowly decrease. Those are the tax payments the repayments coming back from account holders back into the program. So if those two lines intersect, then again, the cash fund will start to go down. And one question I had is, well, how did you make these projections? These projections were made by one of our economists at the Department of Revenue, and we did this a few times. In fact, we sent out this chart a few weeks ago with a much more aggressive forecast, and it had the lines intersecting around 2018. We also looked at it in a more conservative way, and it had them not interjecting at all into the foreseeable future. What you're looking at here is something somewhere in the middle. So it's not too aggressive, not too conservative. It's right there in the middle. This next slide, what you're looking at is the total accounts that are in the program that have a balance. And there's different cohorts that you see up there: active, inactive, disqualified, and canceled. If you want me to get into the definition of those, I can. But the number that you want to note is at the lower right-hand corner, the 9,218. Those are the number of accounts that we have in the program that are either accumulating a balance or have a balance, and they're accumulating interest, and we can expect to get money at some point in the future. The next slide is the total liabilities. So if you note on the upper right-hand corner, that 9,218, that's the number from the previous slide I pointed out. That's the total number of accounts that we have expected to bring in money. And the number right before that, the 153 million and change, that's the balance that we have on all of those 9,218 accounts. The last slide is this is what we have not collected over the last 5 years. So those accounts that we have, and for whatever reason, we've canceled them off, we've written them off, we're not expecting to receive money on them. The total is $2.3 million over the past 5 years, which equates to roughly $500,000 a year. And it was pointed out at the Revenue House Committee last week that, you know, they asked, is that a small number? And in the grand scheme of things, it is a small number. It's less than 3% of money coming in. But it's important that we noted out that there is some accounts that we do have to write off. Thank you very much for your time. Are there any questions?
Well, I have one, and that is the law that changed from compound interest to simple interest. Seems like it would have an effect on revenues. Do you know the policy reason for that was?
Senator Haas, your question is, do I know what the policy was regarding that change?
Why that was done? I mean, I know you didn't do it. It was a legislative change, but.
Mr. Chair, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. I believe the simple interest, when we looked at it back in 2011, was the first time it had been looked at in my memory, and which was over a dozen years. And I think that when it actually – simple interest, very few debts and no tax programs rely on simple interest. It was the only kind of an outlier for simple interest. And when you looked at that in terms of what would the compound interest rate equivalent be, it was very, very small for most accounts. And so the thought was is that if we're going to try to recover this fund from the brinks of disaster or implosion, we needed to look at a lot of different areas of how can we get a reasonable return on the money that we're extending for the program so that future seniors and future disabled people will be able to be on the program. And so the idea was is just to change that to compound. I think actually in the forecasts I had seen and have seen to date, it really doesn't make a lot of difference.
Wait a second. Maybe I misheard then. I thought that it was changed back to simple interest. It's not simple interest now?
I'm sorry. Yes. It changed.
So I understand where you're saying exactly to that point, but then it got changed back to simple interest.
Right. And what I was getting to was that the forecasts weren't really showing that was going to bring in a lot of money, but the volume of noise and concern from constituents was really high, and so the trade-off there was to say, look, there's a big concern about it. It really doesn't bring in a lot of money. Let's just change it back. So that's what That's what happened. The reason why it was put out to 2016 was because of the core systems replacement project that Bronson mentioned. Rather than try to change the program right in the middle of a program change, we put it out there in 2016. And if we can do it earlier, we're planning to do it earlier.
Thank you, sir. Just a question, because it's disabled citizens, and then there's a recertification every 2 years. I'm assuming if you're, for example, a 100% disabled veteran, it's really the other categories that you're going through, the other stipulars. You're not making more than $1 million or whatever all the calculations that triggers the recertification. Because obviously, if you're, it doesn't matter whether you're a veteran or not, if you're 100% disabled, you're still 100% disabled. It's the other triggering factors, isn't it? The bumper boards we put on. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, that's correct. It's just like the 62. Once someone's 62, they're not going to be as qualified in the future for bumping under that, right? So, exactly.
Well, some people hope to.
Two questions. The first one, you said that they can't have more than $500,000 in assets. Does that include the real property, too?
Senator Haas, Chair Haas, Senator Bearsugar. The homestead under the deferral program does not count towards that $500,000 limitation. Okay. It does not count. So it's other assets besides their homestead.
Right. Did you have another one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other question I have, you have some that you write off. What would be the reasons for writing some off?
Chair Haas, Senator Bearsugar. There are multiple reasons for writing them off. We don't have them listed out, you know, that we can give you handily, but it's from everything from a possible foreclosure to simply someone passing away and then their estate not having enough money to pay off their deferral account. Maybe they have a reverse mortgage and that there's no equity in the home. So those are just a few of the reasons why we haven't collected. There are accounts that are uncollectible.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Ryan.
Thank you. Two questions as well. One is, you talked about the reverse mortgage. The answer you just gave implies that the reverse mortgage takes precedent over the lien. Is that correct?
Chair Haas, Senator Riley, I just want to quantify this statement by saying that I'm not a loan officer. And so I don't know all the ins and outs of the reverse mortgage program, but typically it's my understanding that a mortgage company is not going to loan money unless they're in first position. So typically a reverse mortgage will be in first position, and that will mean that the deferral program's lien will be in second position. So if a disqualifying event happens, then the mortgage company will get paid off first, and then whatever's left over, if there's anything left over, will then go to the deferral program.
Okay. And secondly, what's the current income that qualifies for the program?
Mr. Chair, Senator Riley, right now it is $43,000.
Thank you.
And that's indeed.
That's indexed every year, correct. That changes every year.
Thank you.
Other questions? Well, it looks like things are sort of stable now after those raids 6 or 7 years ago, but there's still the disquieting intersection of those lines somewhere a couple of years out. What would your advice be, Bronson, since you look at this in terms of if there's any necessary action now to keep those lines from intersecting or keep the ship stable?
Senator Haas, it's my understanding you're asking for my advice. As the program administrator, I'm more than willing to administrate any changes that you make. I think the changes that have been that have gone on in the last 4 years have served us well. We've been able to administer those and implement new staff and new positions. Any more changes that go on, we would have to take a look at those financially and see how they would impact the program. Right now there have been a few bills placed out there, but we don't have anything that I know of concrete that we've analyzed and tried to find out if this will have a fiscal impact on our administration or not. But if we continue on the rate we're going, I think that we'll be okay, the forecast shows that the lines are going down or are getting closer together. But I think we can take a look at that in a couple of years once we get some stability, since there's been changes every year for the last 4 years. If there's no changes for a few years, then that will get us to a stabilized point that we can make a better projection.
If I might. Okay. Senator House. Yes, I think the changes from 2011, the major changes that added the additional requirements, they nuanced a lot of the requirements to make it make the program sustainable. And then since then, every session, there's been changes that have nuanced that a little bit to make it more fair. And I think that's what we'll see in the future, is more bills to make it a little more fair. And as that comes, it tends to provide more work. So we didn't initially anticipate how much work it would be to do the kinds of changes that House Bill 2510 required, or 2543 from 2011. Although we had to add some staff to manage those additional calls and the additional forms and the recertifications and all of that, and so we do have a policy option package before Ways and Means this session to add several staff, I'm not sure how many exactly, but to be able to actually provide the support for the program that it's requiring. So I guess that all is to say that should future bills come, we it's hard to forecast the effects on the revolving account as changes happen every single session. And then also it's hard to know how much additional work that's going to be. So I just put that out there.
Okay. Senator Boakley, did you have a question?
Yeah, I just a quick follow-up on the disabled side. In looking at 2543 changes, if an individual, disabled individual passes away and they still meet all of the other requirements, is the house and the family still bumped out of the program?
Mr. Chair, Senator Broquist, yes, if the account holder passes away, that triggers a disqualifying event. So depending on when they pass away throughout the year, the account balance becomes due August 15th, and that balance cannot be transferred to the heirs. It has to be paid.
Senator Edwards.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Being new to this committee, I've never had to delve into the details of this program, although I understand from a high level how it works. But what I'm wondering is the cash balance, so as we have demographic changes over time, how do people in the early years coming into the program versus folks that have been in the program for, say, 10, 15 years, what type of, does that affect the cash balance, and what are the factors involved that drive that? Cash balance either up or down, or the health of the program overall? Or did I just completely miss the mark with that question? It's actually
Mr. Chair,
no
Senator
interplay
Edwards.
Whatsoever.
Oh, Mr. Chair, Senator Edwards, right now we don't keep statistics like that. Our current program doesn't allow us to, and so we don't have that kind of analysis completed. We did do a study, not we, but OSU did a study in 2011-2012 on the program, a socioeconomic study, and some of that information, if you take a look at that, and we can forward it to you if you don't have it, but some of those answers that you're asking might be in there.
Hmm. Okay. Many thanks for that excellent overview. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
I'll close public hearing and 8:36, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 262. Christine.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 262 would increase the fee for the oil spill prevention program and expand the use of monies in the oil spillage control fund to include planning and preparedness activities in planning for oil spills. The measure also expands reporting requirements to include the penalties recovered by the department for civil penalties for the willful and negligent discharge of oil and the activities of the department in collecting penalties for oil spills.
Thank you. Bruce is here to give us the overview. This feels like a Ways and Means fees bill. And we have it here.
Chair Haas and members of the committee, I am Bruce Gillis, and I manage the emergency response program for the Department of Environmental Quality in our operations divisions of headquarters. I'm here today to support Senate Bill 262, Oregon's oil spill contingency planning bill. DEQ works closely with the maritime and petroleum industries to develop and implement strategies for preventing and responding to oil spills. Approval of Senate Bill 262 allows DEQ to maintain resources needed to protect the marine environment from risks from oil spills and to ensure that spills are cleaned up quickly and efficiently. Our responsibilities include review and approval of industry-prepared spill response plans. These plans, we now have, are required of vessels and facilities and pipelines that handle large volumes of petroleum products, and they provide specific procedures for spill prevention and spill response. Development of geographic response plans. Geographic response plans are pre-approved tactics for minimizing the damage of natural resources when spills do occur. And third, participation in industry drills and exercises. These drills and exercises help ensure that adequate equipment is available and the response personnel are properly trained to respond to oil spills in Oregon. DEQ worked over the past year with a stakeholder group to revise the fees needed to pay for DEQ's oil spill contingency planning program. When the program was initially funded in 1991, fees were intended to support about four full-time positions. The last fee increase was implemented in 2007. In the current biennium, DEQ is operating with less than 2.5 positions with the funding we're receiving. As a result, we've had to limit a number of drills and exercises we participate with industry. The proposed fees will support about 3.25 positions. DEQ can perform an effective level of service with this level of staffing and ensure a viable program. We believe the fee increases we are proposing are supported by representatives of the maritime and petroleum industry. In the absence of any fee increase, DEQ will have to further reduce staffing to less than two full-time positions over time. At that level, DEQ will not be able to effectively support meaningful participation in industry drills and exercises that will affect our response to maritime spills. Senate Bill 262 would also allow DEQ to use funds from our Oil Spillage Control Fund to pay for training, response exercises, inspections, and other activities that are consistent with the intent of the Oil Spill Contingency Planning Program. Additionally, if Senate Bill 262 is amended, both DEQ and our industry partners agree that funding of the Oil Spill Contingency Control Fund and use of that fund should be included in the annual report required under ORS 468B-412, which provides similar information with regard to our oil spill contingency planning fees. Oil spilled into our waters of the state can devastate natural resources and seriously impact shipping and economic activities. Senate Bill 262 gives DEQ the ability to continue to effectively implement Oregon's oil spill contingency planning program, and we urge its passage. Thank you. And I would like to mention that it has been gone, this bill has gone through the previous committee, what was that? Senate Environment and Natural Resources. Senator Edwards was the chair for that committee.
So this looks familiar to you.
Passed unanimously. I don't, to be honest, to To be honest, Mr. Chair, I've been trying to redirect, unless it's new policy, and this has some new policy in it, but I've been trying to redirect fee bills from the Environment and Natural Resources Committee to Ways and Means where they can be considered in the context of the entire budget. I'm not sure why this one was sent here, but whatever.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Senator Bocas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you briefly outline, I mean, you mentioned the stakeholder group here, and I think, you know, I chair the Emergency Preparedness Committee. Could you explain who the stakeholder group was that participated in this, please?
Sure. Columbia River Steamship Operators, Marine and Fire Safety Administration, petroleum industry were the primary members that we worked with on the bill and the fee structure.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
468B060, page 2, lines 18 and 19. What are the parameters on restoring fish and wildlife habitat, including restoration, so on and so forth? Are these directly related to the spill itself, or are these a wider parameters? I'm looking at the ORS, and it doesn't seem clear.
Chair Haas, Senator Boquist, could you repeat that question, please?
Do you have the bill in front of you?
Yes.
If you turn to page 2, lines 18, 19, this is added language to the fee. This is what the fee can be utilized for. And as you pointed out, you don't have enough funds right now to participate in existing drills. So this fee increase not only has to pay for what you're doing now, but items 8 through 19 have to be paid for. And I'm specifically looking at section F, in which restoring habitat, which of course is good, but is this in direct relationship to an oil spill, or is this a broader relating?
Senator Haas, Chair Haas, Senator Boquist, I believe this was intended to provide a global availability to use that fund. Typically, industry, if they spill, they would bear the burden of restoring the habitat. In the event that where there are circumstances where a party was not able to undertake that activity, this would give the state the ability to step in and take care of that harm.
I'm ready.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Well, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 262. That winds up our day for today. We will be back tomorrow at the same time. And we will adjourn.